As always, it's nice to be here. It's nice to see you. Okay, so we're going to be speaking about self-esteem and self-discipline. So first, self-esteem. So self-esteem, as everybody in this room knows, is one of the buzzwords today. It's used to include a reason for every possible motivation for good. And every possible limitation is due to lack of self-esteem. So you have to ask yourself a basic question, which is, why should you hold yourself in such high esteem? Do you ever wonder about this? When it comes down to lamaisa, nobody in this room discovered the wheel or finished shas or whatever. So where does this legitimization of feeling we all should have extremely high esteem for ourselves come from? So the answer to that is that we're all deserving of esteem for one reason only. But I want to first tell you what the reason isn't and can't be. Okay, if you were to look at contemporary society, secular society, and you would ask which people are held in high respect, what are the answers you would get? Celebrities, any doctors, what? Wealthy people, basketball players.
How about rabbis?
Okay. So all of these people have reasons. There are reasons why people hold celebrities in high esteem. They're talented. They're beautiful. They do things that the average person can't do, and that's why they have a degree of celebrity. Is that true or not? True. Okay, it's true that all people, basketball players, they are taller than most of us, aren't they? Okay, and that's very important in life if you want to play basketball. And it's true that wealthy people often have a better head for economics than most of us. So why shouldn't they be held in high esteem, one could reasonably ask. So I want to tell you why. All of the things I just mentioned are gifts. So picture yourself at a birthday party. Let's say a 5-year-old's birthday party. And the mother gives her, the little girl, a dream gift. Okay, a doll as big as she is, with a matching dollhouse. Is that a dream gift? So when she's playing, and I'm sure you remember playing with dolls when you were children, she plays that she is the doll, right? So she dresses the doll, she's dressing herself in a certain sense. Could you see where this is so? You remember Barbies. So she confused the gift with the self. Nobody should hold themselves in high esteem because of their gifts, because a gift is not you. A gift is something you were given. So there's no reason why a gifted person inherently is more valuable than somebody who's less gifted. Which takes us back to our original question, which is why should anyone hold themselves in any kind of esteem? So the reason is as follows. It says concerning Adam HaRishon that he was B'tzelem Elokim, he was in Hashem's image. So what that means is that we all have a certain spark of infinity that isn't what you have, but is who you are. And for that reason, any person should hold themselves in some degree of esteem because there's something infinite and something all-powerful about them. Which is not the reason that people hold themselves in high esteem or not in the society in which we live. So most of us instinctively know that we have value on one hand, but because we tend to measure ourselves against the gifts that society values so much, we feel ourselves to be in moderate self-esteem at best. That's one issue. Here's another issue, which is much more significant. The Gemara tells us that before a child is born, the child is enveloped in its mother, and it learns the entire Torah. And before the child could be born, an angel comes and forces the child to make an oath. And this oath has two clauses. The first clause is be righteous and don't be wicked, which is what we'll call having a conscience. But the other clause is, even if the whole world tells you that you're righteous, In your own eyes, you'll be as though you're wicked, meaning we never believe that we're completely okay. So the reason why Hashem implanted this in us, and I bet those of you who've been to therapy, which are all of you, thought that it was your mother, but the reason why we don't believe in ourselves is because inherently Hashem wants us to not believe in ourselves. He wants us to be spiritually ambitious. So because of that, low self-esteem is also part of the picture. But here's why developing one's self-esteem is important. Take this as an axiom. Nobody does what they believe they can't do. Nobody does what they believe they can't do. So in order to function, you have to have a degree of esteem that allows you to do what's your mission, what you legitimately can do, what you were placed in the world to do. So because of this, the need for self-esteem is what keeps you on this path, the path in which you say, I want to be righteous and not be wicked. You have to believe that that's possible. You have to believe that you don't have to be something else. So I want to make a very strong differentiation between self-esteem and tolerance. So in today's educational system, certainly in the secular world, but as Rabbi Beryl Wein will always say, whatever is happening out there drips down here. It's considered to be wrong educationally to ever expect too much from kids, because if they fail, what will happen? Their self-esteem will suffer. Is that true? So I teach in Neve, and I see something about education that becomes more and more observable year by year. The American educational system is getting dumber and dumber and dumber. It's like beyond belief. The vocabulary, the ability to think analytically, the ability to retain information, it's becoming progressively worse. So if you were to ask people, why are you dumbing down the system? The answer that you get is that if you give people a sense of this, that what they're expected to achieve is well within their grasp, then they'll have high self-esteem and they'll perform. And if you give them tasks that are outside their grasp, they'll feel like failures and give up. Is that a Torah that we've all come to believe? So the problem is, the problem that is could be seen when you look at the life of Aaron. On one hand, we're told the Kohanim were great because they're Ohev Shalom, Rodev Shalom, they love peace, they pursue peace. And we have about Aaron HaKohen, he was Midas HaChesed embodied, he believed in everyone. The reason why he could pursue peace is that he genuinely believed that everybody has a certain dimension of wholeness. So he could convey that to somebody else. You're familiar with his method. Two people quarrel. Let's call them Reuven and Shimon. So he'll go to Reuven and say, Shimon really wants to make peace with you, he feels terrible about what he did, he knows he was wrong and you were right. But he's embarrassed. So just act like nothing happened. Be big. Then he'll do the same thing with who? With Shimon. And then when they get together, they both forgive each other and life is rosy. Did any of you ever try this method? Any of you ever try it? No? It doesn't work. Okay, so when I tried it, here's what happened. First of all, they immediately found out that I'd been meddling. And, there was a lot of, she says that you're sorry, you don't seem so sorry. Okay, that kind of thing. But in the end, there was peace between them. They were united in their anger at me. But it does work for a certain kind of person. So I want to talk to you about the kind of person it would work for. It would work for the kind of person who believes what they're saying. So both in the heart of Reuven and Shimon, there's some place that wants to see another person positively and wants relationship and yearns for things to be better. So if you could really see it, then you're credible. If you can't really see it, you're not. So Aaron HaKohen was completely credible. He could make peace between anybody by bringing forth their good traits. Okay, that's one side of the coin. Are any of you the daughters of Kohanim? Okay, you are, okay? So, I hope this won't be too personal. I'm sure it won't. But it says in the Gemara that the daughter of a Kohen shouldn't marry an Am Ha'aretz, an ignoramus. Okay. Okay, I'm sure he knows how to read and all. Okay, whatever. Okay, Baruch Hashem. So the question is, why not? And the answer is, the daughter of a Kohen will not be able to tolerate an ignoramus. Why don't you learn to read already? You know, like there are only 22 letters. Learn one a day. In a month you'll have it. Come on, get it together. Okay, so are Kohanim intolerant? Or are Kohanim love, people who love? So the answer is, if you really believe in human potential, you'll have a certain degree of intolerance. So believing in somebody's potential, believing in their esteem, means that you have expectations. Not you continually lower your standards. The most insulting possible phrase you could ever eject is, from you I didn't expect anything better. Now if it's said with a little syrup, it's even worse. I understand. We all come from different places and have had different experiences in life. Have you considered therapy? Nothing could be more insulting than that. So the idea is that real self-esteem is built on expectations. So that takes us to self-discipline. So let's go back to expectations. What kind of expectations? At the beginning of this year, we said that in contemporary secular society, the people who receive a great deal of public esteem are celebrities, are wealthy people, are basketball players. I can't, like, point at a rant, you should be a I believe in you, you should be a basketball player. That's not going to give you high self-esteem. If you believed me, that I really think that you could and should be a basketball player, that you failed, okay, what will happen? Depression. So does self-esteem come from expectations, or does self-esteem come from self-discipline? They're not the same thing. Expectations could be external and could be artificial. So I want to give you an example of the kind of societal expectation that destroys people. If you try hard enough, you could be size 2. And if you aren't size 2, what does that mean? You didn't try hard enough. That's not a reasonable expectation. What is? A reasonable expectation is that anybody could successfully deal with the moral choices that Hashem places in front of them. So the basis of self-esteem is acknowledging the nisyonos that Hashem put in front of you and believing in your capacity to deal with them. There's a famous parable. Once there was a... Thank you. And the king had a... See? Okay. And the king wanted to make everybody aware of the son's incredible greatness and potential. So he wanted to prove him, which again would mean his doing something that shows his ability. So if you were the king, what would you do? What sort of a challenge would you set before the son? Okay, you would say, give him a part of the kingdom to rule over. Any other ideas? Let him become a general in the army. Let's see how he deals with troops. Let's see whether he succeeds. Let him find the Holy Grail. Okay, you're familiar with all of these legends. Okay, why are none of these tests relevant? Let's think about this. Give him a country to rule, which is, by the way, of the three, the one that's most relevant. Okay, relevant. So the reason why that's not a true test of the son is that half of that test has to do with his ability to rule, and the other half of the test has to do with the willingness of the people of the country to be ruled. So if the country that he's given is one that's inherently easy to rule, a country that's homogeneous, a country that shares values, that proves less about him than one would think. Okay, the other tests. Okay, let's see if he could prevail in war. Half of this has to do with his skill as a general, and what's the other half? The skill of the enemies. Okay, clear? So if the enemies are not that great, and he'll win, that doesn't prove so much. And certainly, any kind of physical test, climb the highest mountain, ford every stream, are you glad I don't? Okay, that doesn't prove anything except that the person is given physical ability. So what test did the king give the son? So in this parable, the king had a beautiful concubine. He told his concubine, who loved the king more than she loved herself, "I want you to try to seduce my son." Now, if you were the concubine, would you agree to do this or not? How many of you would agree to try to seduce the king's son? Okay. How many of you would not agree to try to seduce the king's son? And look how afraid the rest of you are of being wrong. That's what I call no self-esteem. Like, what's the worst thing that can happen? See, you're wrong! Okay, that's wrong. Okay, whatever. Okay, so in the parable, because she loves the king more than she loves herself, she agrees to try to seduce the son. But does she want to succeed or does she want to fail if she truly loves the king? She wants to fail. So her moment of victory is her moment of loss. Could you see where this is? So she wants to be defeated. That's the position of the forces of evil in this world. And indeed, this parable is a Zoharic parable, and it's about what really leads to self-esteem. When you could face the temptations that Hashem sets before you successfully, then you've defeated the seductress, and that should give you a sense of your own esteem. Nothing else is really an accomplishment. Everything else is a gift. So to understand this in greater depth, okay, as you know, David HaMelech at one point was meditating. Although the Siddur had not yet been composed, he knew that ultimately when the Siddur would be composed, we would end the first bracha with what? Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Velokei Avotenu Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. What about David? Now, if this were to happen today, picture this in the political arena. And what about me? Okay, you know. It wouldn't be about self-esteem. It would be about wanting external acknowledgement, which is not the same thing at all. But for David, it was for wanting true esteem. He asked Hashem, why am I not what they are? What am I lacking? Meaning he sincerely wanted to reach a point where his service of Hashem would be as great as theirs. So it wasn't about outward acknowledgement at all. So I want you to hear what Hashem answered him. They were tested and you weren't tested. Okay, so I want to tell you something about the word tested. A test, if it's real, means that there's a 50-50 chance of defeat. So when a person says, oh, I could be tested, I know I'll win, what they're saying doesn't make sense. If they know they'll win, it's not a test. Now let's think about where David was in his life at this point. At this point, which was right before the Bathsheba episode, he had already grown up in an extremely unfavorable environment. You know about his early youth? His brothers believed him to be illegitimate. They treated him as an outcast. Okay. That doesn't lead to self-esteem. That leads to 50 years of therapy. Okay. Then you have his facing off with Goliath. That's not a test. I think many people would consider this to be a test. And then you have the 2 years in which Shaul was pursuing him relentlessly, and he had opportunities where he could have killed Shaul, and he didn't. And that wasn't a test. Then he had his entire family being killed by people who he believed to be his allies. That wasn't a test. Okay, why were those things not a test? Because given who David was, It was less than 50-50. He was strong enough by the gift he was given, which is his particular soul, that he could have gone through that without it being 50-50. Now we're up to Bathsheba. So what happened next is he says to Hashem, test me. Did he know a test means 50-50? Yes. So where was he when he asked for a test? He was on the roof of his palace, looking out. What was he facing? Uriah Hachiti's palace. The words were out of his mouth, test me, and a bird came and snapped the cord that was holding up the machitza around the pool in which Bathsheba was bathing. And he saw her, and that led to the whole Bathsheba story. Now, David wasn't a fool. So when he said, test me, he knew there was a 50-50 chance he would lose. So what would happen if he wins? We know ourselves. Then we would be saying, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei David. Okay? But what if he loses? What did he think would happen then? He knew he might lose. If he didn't think he might lose, it wouldn't be a test. So I want you to hear this carefully. He believed that, and if I lose, I will teach people that you can come back from defeat. And that indeed is one of the klalim of self-esteem. So now we have two things for self-esteem. One is that self-esteem only involves moral tests that Hashem puts before you and your ability to succeed and to believe that you could succeed in those tests. It has nothing to do with gifts. And the other is that failure is not the end of self-esteem. True self-esteem begins when you, in the face of failure, you could say, I could get up anyway. So David said, I'll teach people how to do tshuva. Now, as you know, whenever we talk about David, we usually add his last name. What's his last name? Hamelech. Okay. Just like Avram Avinu of the Avinu family, famous Avinu family. Okay. So David was the second king of Israel. Who was the first? Shaul. Let's talk about Shaul for a moment. Okay, so Shaul's lineage takes him all the way back to who? Who was his ancestor? Binyamin. So Binyamin was different than the other tribes. How was he different? He never bowed to Esav. He wasn't born yet when the other tribes and Yaakov bowed to Esav. Another dimension of self-esteem is believing that you don't have to bow before force that's greater than your own. This is the third dimension. So this could be physical force, or it could be spiritual force. So what that means is if you believe truly that Hashem puts you in situations in which you could prevail, who your opponent is becomes progressively less relevant. So I want to give you a concrete example of this. If you truly believe that whatever test Hashem gives you is one that by definition you could prevail with, it's possible, then the other side doesn't matter. You're not looking at how great are they, how smart are they, how powerful are they. You're looking at yourself. I want to illustrate this. Some of you may have read a book called Subota. Do you know the book that I'm talking about? It's such a good book. You should read. Anyway, it's a children's book. It was written under the pseudonym of Avraham Netzach. The man's real name was Eliezer Nanas. Okay. So who was he? He was a man who was born in Russia. He grew up in a Hasidic family, became a bookkeeper. And during the time that Stalin came to power, as was more or less inevitable with anybody who tried to keep mitzvahs openly, he ended up in Siberia. He made a resolution that no matter what, he's going to keep Shabbos. And it was like he had miracle after miracle happen to him. So after he was released from the Soviet Union, this was, I think, in 1986, he came to live in Israel. And a friend of mine said, do you want to meet him? So I said, who? So she told me. Of course I wanted to meet him. So he was quite an elderly man then. He was living in Shikun Chabad in Yerushalayim. And it was very interesting. He was around 90, 92, 91. I don't remember his exact age. But he looked like a man of 70 or so. And he must have seen that I was kind of surprised. He had received a blessing from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Riatz, that Hashem would give him back all of the years he was in Siberia. He was there for 20 years, and indeed, from his appearance, he seemed 20 years younger than he looked. So I asked him, what held you up? What made you strong? So I want you to hear what he said, because it's very important. He said, in the moments of great nisayon, he would go back to when he was a little child in cheder. And he would go back to hearing his Rebbe singing and teaching Mishnayos, and his own joy in those moments. And he would remind himself, this is who I am. So the self-esteem and belief he had to go through these nisyonos came from spiritual memory. So if you realize your own preciousness in chashivus to Hashem, and you have spiritual memories that you could go back to, that's another cause for self-esteem. So I want to tell you something that moved me deeply today. I was in Far Rockaway, and a woman who was in the shiur showed me a film clip she made on her camera. She was involved in this Shabbos, and the challah baking. She took a clip of the girls, high school girls, I think from Shevach, I'm not sure from which school, maybe not Shevach, some school, and all of the women would come to make challahs were leaving. And the girls were singing to them. They were singing this like old camp song that those of you who went to from camps know, good Shabbos, Tayyar Shabbos, Heilige Shabbos. These women are never going to forget that. So if they want to, they'll be able to tap into those memories in whatever is a true nisayon for them. Okay. So where does self-discipline come in? The real enemy to self-esteem is not being gifted. We demonstrated that. It's not failure. We demonstrated that. It's not difficult situations. We demonstrated that. The real enemy to self-esteem is lack of self-discipline. So why is that the real enemy? What does self-discipline mean? Let's define this word. Self-discipline means when you know what you should do, but you're too weak to do it. So when a person fails in any moral endeavor because of lack of self-discipline, what message did they just receive? I'm weak. And that's the most eroding of all possible messages. So because of this, there are halachot. There's a mitzvah in the Torah not to do ona'a. What does ona'a mean? It means purposely causing pain to another person. So there are two definitions, there are two dimensions of ona'a. One is financial, where you harm somebody financially, not through stealing, but through doing something through which they'll unjustifiably lose, like selling fruit in closed packages with all the bad fruit on bottom and the good fruit on top. So, because surprise, surprise, you take off, Okay, there's another kind of ona'a that's called ona'at dvarim. So that's when you purposely select words to hurt the other person. What kind of words hurt the other person? Words that say in a million different ways, you're weak, you're unable, you failed. Those are the words that are ona'at dvarim. So there are a lot, for those of us, some of us are more sensitive, some of us are less sensitive. So Rambam has a whole slew of laws for the insensitive. What's likely to harm a person? What's likely to erode their self-esteem? So the first thing he says is reminding people of their failures. Okay, well, you used to do this, now you've done tshuva, but you used to do this. Why will that make them feel bad about themselves? Because it tells them again, you're weak. So any reminding people of a past failure is forbidden in the Torah. So I remember I was once teaching this, and you know how like in Neve, sometimes they'll say things that nobody else will say because people like are embarrassed? So a girl said, these laws that you're teaching, do people really keep them? So I said, yes. He said, But, like, what about family life? That's the exception, right? Okay, so no, on the Advarim is for family life as well. Any words you say in which you tell the other person, I remember your failure, is considered to be Ona'at Dvarim. Next, another form of Ona'at Dvarim is if you know that somebody is embarrassed about something, even if you don't think they should be embarrassed about it, bringing it up makes them feel like a failure. So this can include things that are not shameful. Physical disability, which should not be a source of anybody's shame. Divorce, which should not be something that anyone's ashamed of. Being a convert, which is nothing to be ashamed of. Being a Baal Tshuva, which is nothing to be ashamed of. If you know that the person is not comfortable with this, and you bring it up, what you're telling them is you are different and less. And that erodes self-esteem. Even if you think that they're not ashamed of any of this, it's not your place to bring it up. If they want to talk about it, that's their choice, not your choice. Okay, next thing. If you know that people failed in ways that are not even moral, somebody went bankrupt, somebody was in an accident, don't bring it up. That's ona'ah. The worst is purposely embarrassing someone in the presence of others. So as you know, the Gemara equates embarrassing somebody in the presence of others with what? With murder. So the question is, you could ask, very reasonably, look, it's not like murder. When a person is murdered, like, it's finished, they're over, they don't have tomorrow. Lots of times people hear things they don't want to hear, and, you know, they get over it. How could you say it's like murder? Isn't that exaggerated? So the answer that's given in the Gemara is it makes it only more difficult. It's considered like bloodshed because the person turns red, like blood, then turns white, like a corpse. You could say that's just a physical phenomena. So I want to tell you what Maharal says. The message that a person gets when you embarrass them is what? What's the message? So let's talk about what's embarrassing. Different people are embarrassed by different things. Is that true or not? Okay, so the basic rule is the higher a person's spiritual level, the easier it is for them to be embarrassed by what for another person may not seem such a big deal. Okay, clear? So let's look at this realistically. We've all seen homeless people, right? So the person reaches this point, which could happen to anyone. Okay, when they reach this point, if you were to say, that shirt you're wearing, like, that hasn't been in style for at least 2 years, is that embarrassing? No, because they have no expectations from themselves in terms of appearance any longer. If you were to say this to a girl in high school, like, you just killed her. Okay, why? Because she has expectations. So the higher one's expectations are, the higher the embarrassment threshold is. So the idea is, when you embarrass somebody, you kill them, you make them think that the part of them that we spoke about at the beginning of the shiur, which is their godly soul, which is eternal and precious and real, that that's not the real them. Who are they? Their limitation. So I want to give you an example of this. I had a student at Neve who had a job teaching in a middle school in a very bad neighborhood. Does that sound like a great pleasure? So she's also small. She must be like around 5 feet and very Jewish looking. Okay. Does that make it better or worse? Much worse. So one day she came to school and one of her kids, a boy, came in and his shirt was inside out. So she goes over to him and very discreetly whispers, Warren, your shirt's inside out. What happened next? What happened next is that he yelled at her. He said, you white pig, you don't tell me, you Jew face. what I should wear. Okay. Now suppose this happened to you. You go to work one day and your shirt's inside out. So your coworker goes over and says, "Excuse me, lady, your shirt's inside out." What would happen next? You say thank you, go to the bathroom, and fix it, right? What's the difference? Why does one person respond this way and the other one that way? That boy has no identity except his chitzonius. So when you tell him your shirt's inside out, what does he hear? There's something wrong with you. You aren't okay. There's something wrong with you. You have an identity. Someone tells you your shirt's inside out, it's about your shirt. That's all it is. Okay. So now that we understand this, we have two more places to go in our discussion of self-esteem and self-discipline. All authentic self-esteem means you're able to tell yourself, I will decide not what I have, but who I am. I decide who I am. It's not about what gifts I have or don't have. It's not about what other people tell me about myself. It's about my determination to be the person I want, and I have the resources to find that person. I have my memories and I have my knowledge. So once a person is on that level, it's almost impossible to destroy their self-esteem because their self-esteem isn't dependent on somebody from the outside. Hence it says in the Zohar, to whom could you reveal secrets of the Torah? Who's worthy of it? So the answer the Zohar gives is somebody for whom showing great admiration or demonstrating verbal disdain, it's all the same to them. They don't care. It's not important the mark you give them. What's important to them is whether they actualize their potential given by God. So now the question is, what achievements and what potentials are worth acknowledgement for yourself? So the basic rule is as follows. All of the mitzvot lo ta'aseh, all of the mitzvot lo ta'aseh are the source of self-discipline. So that means, when you could say, I could say no to myself, when the Torah says I should say no, that means I am a strong person. I deserve some inner acknowledgement. Any other act of self-discipline is only, at best, relatively meaningful. So let's talk about some mitzvot lo taseh that are difficult to observe. Let's give you an example of a mitzvot lo taseh that's a difficult one, hard to observe. Okay, not speaking Lashon Hara. Okay. So let's, how many people in this room could say honestly that they haven't spoken Lashon Hara the last year? At least you're an honest bunch. And I want to expand it because I want to include several mitzvahs under the same umbrella. How many of you here could say you haven't told a lie in the last 5 years? More perfection. Okay, I want to go on to a couple of Ben Adam Lamakoms. How many of you could say honestly that you haven't found yourself making the same mistakes in halacha? Are you supposed to repeat benching when you forget Yalla Vievo or not? That you may have made 10 years ago. Okay, so those are the things that should be the sense from which our sense of failure could stem. So I want to talk about what that says about you. Let's talk first about speaking Lashon Hara. Why do people like to speak Lashon Hara? Other people like to hear it. So it gives you you get a lot of centrality. Everybody's listening. You go into a room and say, did you hear? What does everybody do? What? All of a sudden they're listening, yeah? Sure. And another reason is it gives you artificial status. If he's so bad and I'm the judge and jury, that feels very good. Okay, clear? You know, the comparison. I always find, like, I shouldn't say, but whatever. For some people, in any case, school reunions end up becoming Lashon Hara festivals. Could you see where this is so? There's always at least a few people who didn't come. Say, whatever happened to Marilyn? You didn't hear? Okay. So that has to do with, again, you feel good by comparison. Okay, clear? So when you say no to speaking Lashon Hara, what are you saying no to? I want you to hear carefully what you said. My chashivas is not dependent on how many people are listening to what I say. My chashivas is not depending on comparison. My chashivas is dependent on my ability to want goodness. That's what builds self-esteem. So when you make a decision not to speak Lashon Hara, the self-esteem comes from an affirmation, not just a denial, an affirmation of your spiritual capacity. So, did any of you ever end up in a situation where somebody asked you to keep a secret, and even in the face of great difficulty, you kept that secret? Did that ever happen to you? So when that does, your self-esteem grows, because you've learned that you could say no to the outside. Let's take another example, telling a lie. Why do people tell lies? Okay, to save themselves embarrassment or disapproval. Is that normal? Okay. Why were you late? Oh, there was a traffic jam. Okay, it wasn't a traffic jam. It was jam on your toast. You had three. Okay, whatever. Okay. Okay, so we lie to avoid disapproval. I want you to think about the last time you were tempted to tell a lie and didn't tell a lie. So, in that situation, when you were tempted and you didn't tell the lie, you're all there, you could think of a situation like this? Mm-hmm. No, I always tell the lie, whatever. Okay. Let's say you were tempted and didn't tell the lie, and you suffered the disapproval. Okay, it wasn't one of those happy ending things. Okay, you suffered the disapproval. Did you feel better in the end or worse? Momentarily worse, afterwards better. Could you see where this is so? Because you lived through disapproval. And if you could live through disapproval, you have every basis of self-esteem intact. Okay, let's look at the mitzvahs bein adam lamakom. You face a temptation in a halachic issue. In dinei mamonos. Okay, although that involves other people, I don't want to go there. Let's say with Shabbos. This actually happened. A friend of mine saw this. It's such a painful story. I had a student who was working for a caterer, for a man. And her job was to set the tables. So she got to the place where the event was taking place on Friday. She's like getting the room ready and setting. When it was already past Shkia, the caterer realized that somehow the plug to all of the hot plates had been removed from the wall. Someone knocked it out of the wall. She told me it was at least 15 minutes after Shkia. This is a firm man. She saw him put the plug back in. Why did he do this? I want you to put words into what he did. Okay. It'll be the end of him for this affair, right? So let's say all the food is cold and the Balei Simcha say, we're not going to pay you for this. He'll lose money. What? Mustamanat, since no tnai was made beforehand and the guy is not nehena. Mustamanat. It's a midoraisa. Okay, but if somebody would have asked the same man 2 days before, I'm making up the name, this isn't his name, Mr. Meyerson, I'll give you $2,000 to break Shabbos. Would he say yes or no?
No.
If you said, you know what, I'll bring it up to $3,000. Will you break Shabbos for $3,000? What will he say? No. So what happened that he broke Shabbos? It's not just the money. The embarrassment, the feeling of failure, the feeling of vulnerability, the feeling of being a schlamazel, listening to all the insults. Could you see where that's really where it is, even more than the money? So that means the day before, the minute before, he was weak on the inside. His inner sense of self was dependent on other people's approval. You understand this? Every time you face a temptation and you experience the disapproval and you survive anyway, what happens is for the next time you're stronger. This is where self-esteem comes from. So the more you struggle, the greater the change in your self-esteem will be. Okay, so now let's talk about real temptations that we have. What are the real temptations that people face today? What do you think?
Money.
There are big money temptations out there. Okay, so again, if you were to ask the average, we all hear about money scandals now and again. Is there anybody who never heard about a money scandal involving an observant person? If you didn't, I'll be happy to give you the name of the site that you can go in online where they'll tell you scandal after scandal. You know, of course, L'shem Shemayim. Okay. But because it's so necessary to rehash the scandals again and again and again. Yeah. So the same person, okay, if you were to ask them, I'll give you again, $2,000. I'll give you $2,000 if you go into somebody's house through the window late at night and take the jewelry. Will they do it? No. So why do frum people sometimes fall? Why do they end up doing things that are wrong financially?
Because they don't think they'll get caught.
Okay. Let's say going in through that window, you won't get caught. It's 4 a.m, nobody is home. You have a map of where the jewelry is. It's not only that. It's because we're so weak sometimes we think that if we don't have enough money to meet our expenses, we'll die. When the truth is, you won't. But the embarrassment of not having creates internal pressure that makes people feel desperate. So in Chovos HaLevavos, the author says, the reason why we fall into the kind of sins that I'm discussing now, which lead to less and less and less inner self-esteem, is because we don't have bitachon in Hashem to the degree that we should. If we were able to recognize that any situation Hashem puts you in that's hard is the one that's going to make you strong, you'd be able to deal with it.
But not all people that steal are in need.
They feel their perception is that they're in need.
Are you sure about that?
In other words, even if what their need is to maintain their standard of living, or the standard of living they think that chashuva people should have, their perception is that there's need. Okay. So who are the people who have real self-esteem? They're the people who can't be shaken. So I want to give you an example of this. I had a very interesting student. Some of you may know who she is. I'm going to disguise it a little bit. She's a very beautiful girl. She at that time was a very beautiful girl. Now she's a woman. Very big degree, a very big career in modeling. And modeling isn't the kind of career that builds your midos. Why? Because it's all about the outside, right? It's all about the outside. So when she came to Neve, she was very much a person whose self-esteem was dependent on the outside. She hadn't yet built inner resources, okay? In the course of the year she was there, she was only there a year, keeping mitzvot built her self-esteem to such a high degree that she actually approached me towards the end of the year, and other people were in the room. In those days, this is like, you know, many years ago when people were coming out of the caves and forming city-states, you know, there used to be something called payphones. How many, is anyone here who's too young to know what I'm talking about? I have to tell you something funny that happened to me. I bought my little granddaughter, who's like two, I bought her like a toy telephone. She had no idea what it is. Like, you know, she's looking at it. You have this box with numbers, and, you know, there's holes for your fingers. And then this funny hat. And what is, you know. So I picked up the receiver, and I'm saying, hello, hello, Hoovy. And she's looking at me like I'm crazy. Everyone knows that's not what a phone looks like. Why, like, why would there be a string on a phone? You know, whatever. So, you know, in ancient times, when there was such a thing as a payphone, there was a trick that people used to do. There were a lot of tricks. One of them involved getting a string around a coin, and then you lower it in, and then you pull it out. Okay, clear? So she, have I spoiled your innocence? Okay, so in any case, so she told me, she was very distraught. She told me she had been doing this all along and making numerous calls to her family in America. And now she realizes that it's wrong, that, you know, stealing from the telephone company is also theft. What should she do? Like, how do you return this money? Now, the reason I'm telling you this true story is because that shows that she moved so deeply that her sense of self had to do with who she is on the inside, instead of who she is on the outside. This is self-esteem. That question revealed enormous self-esteem. I want to go back to something that we spoke about earlier, which is self-esteem in the face of failure. So let's go back to failures. I asked you to think a moment ago about times when you could have told a lie but did tell the truth. What about at the times you could have told the truth but did tell the lie? Okay, do we all have times like that? Okay, let's go back to one of those. So suppose you suffer a real humiliation and you get caught in a lie. Is that embarrassing? Sure it is. Okay, so here are two responses you could make in the face of that failure. Actually, there are three responses. One is to try to deny the fact that you were caught in a lie. No, you got the story wrong. It really was the, you know, okay. Do people do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Another response would be, I can't deal with this. And, like, you know, just sort of running away from it. This is what I think most people would do. The third response is saying, the embarrassment that I feel is a proof that I could tell the truth. And embracing the embarrassment. The fact that I am embarrassed means I believe I could have done better. If I didn't believe I could do better, I wouldn't be embarrassed. So every time you suffer embarrassment, it tells you that you believe in yourself. Now, I told you previously something that seems opposite. We just said, if you embarrass somebody else, you're destroying them. And I'm saying, if you suffer embarrassment, it's telling you that you're okay. Where's the truth? They're both true. When you embarrass somebody else, you don't know how they're going to interpret that embarrassment. They may believe every word you say as being true, and that could destroy them. But with yourself, you have a choice. You could believe the voice of the little critic that says you're a liar and everybody hates you. Or you could believe the voice of your stronger self that says, it's good that you don't accept that in yourself. It's healthy. Thank God she told you that. That'll teach you not to do this again. With yourself, you have choices. With somebody else, they have choices. You don't have choices. So you have to be careful not to embarrass other people. But with yourself, every time you experience shame, you should embrace it. And in fact, it's a skula. if you could suffer embarrassment and not answer back and go into denial, then you're considered to be as strong as the sun at midday, and your tefillahs are heard. And I know a Maisa Shahaya, and I'm changing the facts in this one a little bit. A couple who were married many years without children. The husband was at a wedding. A mistake took place. There was another man at his table who somebody mistakenly thought was trying to avoid him because he owed him money. In fact, the debt had been paid. The person who was upset made a mistake. But he began berating this person. Ah, you saw me coming into the room, you're going to change your tables, right? I mean, you know, you've owed me this money for almost 2 years every time I talk to you. Okay. He's yelling and yelling and yelling and yelling. The man didn't answer back, not because he's a tzaddik gomor, not because he was thinking this is min hashamayim to make me confront things. The truth is, and he said this later, he was so embarrassed he couldn't get the words out of his mouth. He just wanted to disappear. But he didn't answer. And when the other man, finished yelling, he finished, all of his wrath was gone, and he went off somewhere else. The hero of the story was about to defend himself to the other people at the table. The man who hadn't had children in years grabbed him by the hand and said, "Don't say anything." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Just give me a bracha." He gave the guy a bracha, and he had a child within the year. So, and this is even when the silence was unintentional. I've heard this story repeated by other people, in which case the person was a tzaddik, and that wasn't what happened. But that's how great it is, because that's what builds you. The ability to say, "I can do better." So I want to bring this into chinuch. So again, we have this narrow bridge. Is the message you're giving your child by expressing strongly that you have expectations going to build them by saying, "I think you can, so get it together"? Or is it going to destroy them by your saying, "I don't think much of you, I don't believe in you"? It could go either way. So I presently have a student at Neve from a frum family, the Hasidish family in fact, who, whenever you say anything that sounds even remotely like the word Beis Yaakov, you get 5 minutes worth. Okay, clear? It doesn't have to be Beis Yaakov. You could be saying, "I think that Yaakov Smalkin is my..." Okay. "Are you talking about me? Let me tell you about..." whatever. So, she's a very emotional sort of a person. I wasn't sure how much logic she would hear. But I finally asked her, "What do? They hung you up by your fingers on the fan and rotated you? What do they do already in Beis Yaakov?" So it came down to this. It was a few incidents, but they all had one thing in common. She was told by her teachers, "You're not okay." That's all it was. And there are a lot of different nusachs of "you're not okay." There's "you're not smart enough." There's "you're not from enough." There's "you're not with it enough." But the bottom line is they were telling her, "You're not okay." So the teachers were wrong. They could have killed her. But I want to tell you something. If she had been in a place where she believed in herself through self-discipline beforehand, she would think, "What a dumb teacher. Why is she saying this?" Okay, clear? Okay, but that's not where she was coming from. Now, I want to tell you a story of the exact opposite nature. One of my kids is the kind who could fly through things very easily. You know what I mean? Sunny personality, nice looking, smart enough to get good grades without really trying very hard. Not excellent grades, but good grades. 85 is also good. Okay, so he's going through his school career. How much effort is he putting into anything? Nothing. And he's happy, and everybody else is happy, and as long as everybody's happy, then let's just be happy. Okay. And, every so often, I would let out little things like, "Maybe apply yourself." I said, "Well, what's, I'm getting good marks. What's the problem, Okay. He went into eighth grade. His eighth grade teacher, this was in a Yerushalmi cheder. His eighth grade teacher was like everybody's nightmare Rebbe from the books. Some of you may have seen those old Haskalah novels where, you know, the Rebbe who you... Okay. This was his last year in teaching. He was retiring, so he couldn't be fired. He's leaving. See, he was like at his peak, if you know what I mean. So I want you to see him in your mind's eye, like, you know, tall, very thin, a chain smoker, long beard, long pais. You could see him? So here they are the first day or so in school, and he's calling out, you know, the boys to read pieces of the Gemara they're learning. He says, okay, Heller, you read. So, you know, he reads and he translates and he explains, here's the question, here's the answer. Nothing wrong, but nothing too deep either. And he says, you have to see this book. That's what you think Tosfos is saying? If that's what you think Tosfos is saying, why is he saying anything? Rashi said that, didn't he? Think, Heller, what Tosfos saying? And he didn't let go. He tried giving him his usual slick answers. You know, well, you know, maybe he's just like using different words to give expression to like the basic same kind of thought. That's what you think Tosfos is doing? What do you think, he was paid by the word? Okay, you know. Okay, he told me at the end of the year, I didn't know about any of this. He said, that was the best teacher I ever had in my life. Okay, he taught him to think. He taught him to believe that he could do better than superficiality. He taught him to like the Gemara instead of just like swim through it until you could like eat an Arctic. Okay. But at the very end of the year, he says, are you sure he's retiring? And I said, yeah, that's what they tell me. He's like for sure leaving. They made him a party. He says, because next year, and he mentioned his next brother's name, if he's in his class, he'll kill him. So everything depends, you know, with your own kids on what's going on the inside. But the basic picture is this. If you expect nothing, the message you're giving your child is you're too weak for me to expect anything. If you expect more than the child could actually give you, he'll fail. And his failure will prove to him that he's weak. So you have to know your child well enough to be able to walk this narrow bridge. So let's say you make a misjudgment. Such things could happen. What do you say? You expect more from a child than he could do. And you see that you made a mistake. What do you say then? You say, the day will come you'll be able to do it like nothing. I made a mistake. That's not today. You could admit a mistake. Okay, let's say you make a mistake in the other way. You expect too little. You could be honest. You could say, you could do more than that. Do it better. Now let's look at ourselves. Now that we looked at the world and our children, let's look at ourselves. So when you look at yourself, you're going to see both successes and failures. You have to let both your successes and your failures contribute to your self-esteem. Your successes, and we all have successes. Your successes prove to you who you could be. Your failures prove to you that you have the capacity to be ashamed and to want more. So either way, you could draw self-esteem when you look at yourself honestly. But which do we see more readily, our successes or our failures? How many of you say successes? How many of you say failures? Okay, and the rest of you are afraid to say anything because maybe you'll be wrong. I'll embarrass you. Okay. So my experience is like this. If I were to hand out papers, as I do sometimes to girls in Nevada, I say, write down your failures, I'm giving you 1 minute. All of your flaws and failures. What happens after a minute? I need more paper, I didn't finish. Okay. Tell you, write down your virtues and successes. What happens after a minute? After less than a minute, they say, I'm done. Okay. That's because the Yetzer Hara has an interest. The Yetzer Hara wants you to believe that you're incapable of success. So because of this, especially nowadays, when for all sorts of reasons we've been very weakened, even though the Balei Musar will say at the end of the day, go over your day and think of your failures, I want to give you a different Eitzah. At the end of the day, go over your day and think of your successes. Think of all of the choices that you made where it could have gone either way. Think of all of the times when you didn't say what you shouldn't say. Think of all of the times when you were too tired to do what you need to do and you got up anyway. And let that be the core of your self-definition. So to tie things together, what we were saying is that self-esteem is inherent on the basis of your godliness, not on the basis of your gifts or what people say about you or your expectations. We said that real self-esteem could be destroyed through humiliation of another person, or it could be built through affirmation. We said with ourselves, the source of true self-esteem is any act of self-discipline, and that even a failure, the fact that you feel ashamed of the failure, could also be a building block in your own self-esteem. We said that children's self-esteem is fragile, and because of that you have to walk a very narrow bridge, but you could remedy your mistakes by being honest. We said that making, finally, a cheshbon nefesh that's positive at the end of the day could make you into the person who believes in yourself and has the self-esteem to meet nisyonos. So if you have any questions, the time to ask is now. Okay, yeah? Yes. So, okay, so I'm going to repeat the question. I said that self-esteem is built by overcoming as opposed to doing. So what about mitzvot asay that are difficult? Let's say you find giving tzedakah difficult and you give tzedakah. Or you find being pleasant difficult. You know, like, want to be pleasant. Okay, you know, so you force yourself to smile when you see people you know. Okay, whatever. So the idea is like this. A mitzvah lo taseh by I'm going to give you a longer answer than your question might need, because it's a bigger question than you may realize. All secular law is negative. For instance, there'll be speed limits. Like you could, I don't know, what's the speed limit in America? What? 55. So it means you're not allowed to drive faster than 55, right? But there's no law requiring you to drive at all. If you don't want to drive, don't drive. Okay, you know, got this? There's no, you must drive 55. There's only, if you're driving, not further than 55. And this holds for all secular law. So the reason is that the underlying assumption in secular law is as follows. How many of you think there should be no traffic laws? Okay, the anarchist is with us. Even though almost all of you believe there should be traffic laws, how many of you always keep the traffic laws? Okay, so yes, there are some people who stop, you know, like at the stop sign 4 a.m. of an empty street, but most of us were not. So the idea is we believe in the principles, but when it comes to the practice, the part of us that's not godly sometimes prevails. So all mitzvot lo taseh have to do with affirming the spiritual self by suppressing the animal self. Okay? Only in halacha do you have mitzvot aseh. Yes, you have to do this, you have to do this. The sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach are all lo taseh. Even mishpat has to do with not having crooked courts rather than, yes, having good courts. So the idea of a mitzvah aseh is giving your spiritual self a voice, but not necessarily fighting a battle. Okay, clear? Okay, more questions? Yeah?
You said before that many achievements that people achieve are merely gifts.
Yeah.
But isn't it also true, like, if a person becomes a doctor or something, that they have worked for many, many hours, and even that basketball player or the ballet dancer, they've spent a gazillion amount of time working on it. Clearly they have a gift, but they've taken it to an amazing level.
Right. So you're not going to like my answer, okay? I'm warning you. The Romans had three major philosophies. One of them was academia, which is that all learning is inherently valuable. Another, I don't have to take you through all three, but one of them was the Spartan ethic, which is that any effort is noble because there's effort and battle. So in Spartacus, for instance, one of their myths involved a man who was a boy, actually, who was able to keep smiling as the fox ate his innards. He was attacked by a fox. He was that strong. He could overcome his desire to shout or cry out in pain. So their ethos was that any achievement is an achievement in direct relationship to how much effort was put in. The Judaic view is that effort is only valuable if the achievement itself has inherent nobility. So in the example you just gave of an athlete and of a doctor, being a doctor is a big deal. There's most people will not say medical school is a breeze, followed by the greater breeze of internship and residency. Having said that, though, there are a lot of reasons why a person could choose to practice medicine. One reason is to heal and to sustain himself and his family, but there are lots of other reasons, too. So whether there's inherent nobility in this from a Judaic perspective depends on what his motivation is. There's certainly, from a Judaic perspective, nothing inherently noble about being a basketball player. It's not negative either, but it's not noble.
Okay. Yeah.
Tell me if you think that your kid has the ability to do like really well in school and get A's, you should pressure them to get good grades and not just say do your best.
Yes. Now by pressure, there's pressure and pressure. One kind of pressure is holding it out as an expectation, okay, which creates emotional pressure. So I'll give you an example of this, not with grades for a moment. So when my mother was growing up on the Lower East Side, okay, it was unheard of for Jewish girls to end up as streetwalkers or Jewish boys to quit school before they graduate high school. But their neighbors, their non-Jewish neighbors, the Italians, the Irish, these things were not unheard of. So I was reading about the kind of lives they were living, and the incredible, you know, the slums, the economic pressures. I asked my mother, how come it happened like that? What did the parents do to keep their kids in line? So she said, my father would have killed my brothers if they quit school. Now, he wouldn't have really have killed them, but his expectations were so clearly there that they would have felt like they were cut off, you know, but they had the ability not to quit school. You understand this? So a parent has to be able to create expectations and see that that those expectations are really upheld. But they have to have their hand on the pulse well enough to know that the expectations are realistic. So an example that I saw this extremely moving film clip that someone took a few years ago of Rav Ovadia. He was explaining halacha to his four-year-old grandchild. So one of the more, it's Shemitah now, so one of the more complicated halachas of Shemitah is Otzar Beis Din. How do you explain this to a four-year-old? Do you all understand Otzar Beis Din? Okay. Somebody grew chasa, right? You like chasa? Chaval on the chasa. It says in the Torah not to grow things in Shemitah. And you can't fool and say it grew by itself. That's called svichin. Now we all know what svichin are. Okay. And it says you can't pick it, you can't sell it. But what's going to be with the chasa? So you can't do business with it, but you're allowed to just take what you need today. So you could tell the men from the Beis Din, you take for all of the neighbors. And then they do, and then they sell it to you, and they charge for the man who picks it. Isn't that nice? The four-year-old understood, Otzar Beis Din. Got this? You send a shaliach, and it can't be svichin, the whole thing. Okay, he clearly believed that a 4-year-old could understand Otzer Beistin. Most people would be, what would most people be telling their 4-year-old? Mama bear, papa bear, and baby bear, okay? So you could have expectations, but you have to have realism at the same time. Okay, yeah? Right.
It wouldn't be worse because the person is still there, and then the people that were there, and then in front of the people that she was embarrassed by, or he was embarrassed by.
It's embarrassing someone is a terrible sin, and it's considered like murder but not murder, meaning the earthly Beistin will kill somebody who physically murders their victim in the presence of two witnesses who are valid witnesses, but they won't kill someone who humiliated somebody in the presence of two valid witnesses. So on a simple level, this is my own, I'm assuming this to be true, is that when a person would actually kill somebody physically, the effect upon society, if you were to let this go, in fact the Chinuch does say something like this, would be to diminish the value of life so gravely that the damage you do society could only be redeemed through the death of the murderer. Misha'en Cain, if a person humiliates someone, there's the possibility of asking their forgiveness, there's the possibility of the person developing self-esteem in other ways. The damage you do society seems to be less grave.
And the second one is, if somebody's, like, saying Lashon Hara, and of course there are ways to go about it where you can, like, say, you know, I don't want to hear it or whatever, but a lot of the time the person ends up embarrassing that person.
Mm-hmm. So since we all know that people will want to speak Lashon Hara, right? Anybody here think, no, the people I know would never, okay. So there's a basic rule, which is if you don't prepare yourself, then you're not going to be ready. So everybody has to have a whole repertoire of subject changers. Okay, clear? Look, Halley's Comet! Okay, whatever. My back! Okay, so, I mean, if the people who you're dealing with are people who know you, who are from, and you could be discreet, you should say, why talk about people? It's better to raise their consciousness. But if they're not, this is what, you know, jokes from the New Yorker and Reader's Digest were created by God for. This is, you know, like, have a repertoire.
Okay.
Yes. You have to find things they could succeed in that'll prove to them that they're strong. You have to do it. No, it could even be by not doing negative. I believe that you could play with the baby all afternoon, and like, you have the patience for him. You've always been able to do this. No, it's not disobeying me. It's not, you know, like, it's not, there's a lot of not. You have to find some area where the child has to say no to his impulsivity and succeeds. Even if it's, I'm sending you with this cake to the neighbor who gave birth. You don't sample it on the way. And you know he's not going to. Even that builds self-esteem. But sometimes, especially if a child has been damaged by failure, you have to mamish pull up the floorboards to find areas in which he could have some level of self-esteem, even if it means taking care of a plant, which requires self-discipline and not forgetting. Whatever it is, you have to find something.
You tell them not to do something that you know they won't do.
So you tell them something that requires being self-disciplined, that you know they're capable of meeting the challenge that brings forth. Okay, yeah?
So imagine having their self-esteem. What about when they are totally drawn to their own self-esteem, and they think maybe that they are capable of X, but you know they're really capable of more than that.
Right. Okay, so with husbands, it's a lot more complex. Okay, as you may have noticed. As you all know, it's every man's dream to be married to his mashgiach. Like, isn't it, like, you know? So that's a role that no wife needs or wants. But a man's real dream, every husband's secret dream, is to have a happy wife who thinks the world of him. Is that not so? So the basic rule is always ask for what you want as opposed to criticizing what you don't want. You understand this? So let's say you would like to see your husband learn more. And he does learn some. He doesn't learn nothing. And you say, like, could you say something like at the Shabbos table? And he says something that came straight out of Torah Tidbits. Okay. So what you want is something more and deeper. You would begin by saying, wow, I'm so happy. It was like, I remember when I was still in some, I always wanted it like a Shabbos table where there's, like, you know, the Ima, the Abba, the Yeladim, and somebody says Torah. That was great. Okay, next week, could you make it more? Okay, clear. That's how to do it. Because what they want is your happiness. That's called kavod, in case you didn't. Okay, women want love, men want kavod. It's okay. Going once, going twice, don't go yet. I have, as always, my tzedakah envelopes.
There's a question over here.
Okay, let me just get my envelopes and I'll hear the question. Okay. So, as you ask the question, I have two envelopes. One of them is for the Kol El Mishneh Berurah, which some of you might recall from previously. So this is, if you could speak to me afterwards or write your name on the back. It's the Yisachar Zvulun for people learning Mishneh Berurah. They actually will sign a binding contract giving their schar to you. If this isn't something that you feel you could enter at this time, so put in whatever you could afford. Okay, that's this. For those of you, especially if anyone's not married or whose husband isn't learning, that might be a way of getting the Swiss of learning Torah. Normally I collect for Neve collars. Halavai, I should have a collar. Right now I don't have a Neve collar who's getting married and needs money.
Wow.
But, okay, is that getting off the hook? What? No one is engaged right now. What do? Halavai, I should have. I should have 10 collars when I come back. But what do I hear? Okay, but right now I don't have any color. Okay, but what I do have is a girl who can't give anything to Neve at all for her maintenance, Gornish, nothing. That's her life situation. I could tell you her whole story. Neve nowadays does ask for at least something. This girl could give nothing. She also needs money for therapy. So this is for a Neve student. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.